We need to talk about the Ayn Rand problem.
It's a problem now.
It's three times is a pattern.
Three times is such a pattern.
And I will say, you know, it's not an Ayn Rand quote. It's an H.L. Mencken quote. And the quote is, every normal man must be tempted from time to time to spit on his hands, hoist a black flag, and slit throats. Which, like, ooh, fun, sexy, but not
crazy
good.
Crazy quote, theoretically. Sorry, I know ooh, fun, sexy. Fucking buck wild thing
no.
for this guy to say. Sometimes
Wait.
Guys just need to do a little war and pillaging. Like,
Wait,
what?
But hold on. It gets worse when I give you some this context, okay? He was very, like, pro-war, but, like, anti, like, America. He didn't want America to join World War I and World War II, but he, like, loved war as a concept.
Big so, fan like, of war.
He has this quote, war is a good thing because it is honest. It admits the central fact of human nature. A nation too long at peace becomes a sort of gigantic old maid.
Okay. This man was not a MILF lover, for real.
Absolutely not. We love a spinster in this house.
This guy MILF enemy, I think.
Yeah. Also, he was obsessed with Friedrich Nietzsche. And he was an outspoken opponent of organized religion, theism, censorship, populism, and representative democracy.
Really? The thing about objectivists and people who are loved by objectivists, it's like the most scattershot psychology you can have.
Yeah, like, and he didn't like representative democracy, which is what we are in America, by the way. We vote for representatives. We don't just, like, vote on every opinion. We elect people to vote for us. That's a representative democracy. It's what we are. But he says that it's a system in which inferior men dominate their superiors.
Which, this guy has, like, some issues, I think.
He was also, during the Great Depression, he was anti the New Deal. This guy would have loved Reagan.
I love how every new thing you are telling me about this man just makes more and more sense. I'm like, oh yeah, Ayn Rand loved this guy, thought he was a great columnist. Yeah, that tracks, sure.
Yeah, yeah. He like was like, go publish her books and stuff. And in return, she was like, this guy rocks. Also, he's been accused of being racist and anti-Semitic, but other people defend him and say he wasn't racist. He was just like elitist. Which, like, oh, yeah, that has nothing to do with racism.
Sure, there's no racism element to that, actually. There's not at all. Not a single one.
It's wild. Also, he's from Baltimore, and he has the largest collection of his works are held in the Mencken Room in the central branch of the Enoch Pratt Free Library, which I have a library card to, and I'm so tempted. I'm not going to. I hate this guy. But the temptation to go be like, and this is wrong, and this is wrong, and I hate this, and...
just sort of spend a day just really dragging this guy. Also, like, it's kind of crazy that we got two very directly related to Ayn Rand quotes, like, in a row.
Yeah.
Like, what were they on in, like, June of 2004 when they were writing these episodes? Like, what was going on?
2008.
June of 2008, sorry, whatever. Yeah.
And the funniest thing, though, is that the ending quote is Eisenhower, who Ayn Rand hated Eisenhower. Over here, we like Ike, okay? Ayn Rand hated Eisenhower. So it's, like, so funny that we start with this, like, hell yeah, war. And then the second one was, like, fuck Eisenhower. The second one is Eisenhower. It's just so wild to me.
What a beginning quote for them to start this episode on. They're like, sometimes like, oh, no. Guys just feel an overwhelming urge to die in war. And it's like, okay, come on, chill out, bud.
Also, like, this episode, like,
not about that.
Well, it's about that, like, you know, masculinity and then feeling a masculine. It's like every now and then a guy just has to, like, go out and bring a man and kill some shit. That's the quote, right? But, like, in relation to an episode where a man feels so are we blaming the wife in this episode?
She got murdered before she was dead the whole time. I don't want to blame her for jack shit.
I just
this
like
this dude saw a car coming to hit his daughter and then did not physically move his body to move his daughter. Like, my guy, you get hit by that car first. Absolutely. Not to blame this man. Tragic accident. But also, he was just sitting on the ground. He did not attempt to get up. Well, reach out and grab your kid. What the fuck?
Well, yes. I think also, though, the fact that that car was like, oh, I'm just going to go around him, but like so fast.
Like, literally.
Also, why that side? Go on. Whatever. It's not the dad's fault, but like, in what world? I always think about my dad. He told me this once that like, if my stepmom were like about to get hit by a bus, he would run and push her out of the way. But he'd be like, oh, god damn it. Right. If I was about to get hit by a bus, he would be moving before he registered what was happening.
Yeah.
Like, he was like, he was like that parental instinct of just like, Spidey senses my kid is in danger. I'm already in front of that bus before I know I moved. You know? So, like, the fact that the dad... Also, he's trying to change the tire. That car isn't even... It's not jacked up.
Like, literally! It's still, like, on the ground. That's what I was thinking, too! The car isn't jacked up, and the kid is coming out of the driver's seat. What the fuck, homie? Keep her in the back!
Literally just, like, shut the door and roll down a window. Like, you don't have to have the door open.
Literally! It fucking...
That's a child. He just made a lot of
bad decisions. This episode is so wild for so many reasons. But like...
I feel like it's... I just like can't entirely tell what the message is. Like, is it that he should have been more of a man? Like, it is his failing as a man that he ended up like losing his daughter. And then like, he doesn't know how to change a tire. So like, his daughter died. And now he's like suffering because of it. You know, like, what's like... Or was it that like... You know, guys can be softer, but women don't be so domineering. His domineering wife pushed him. Like, what's the
message? But also at the same point, like, the message being that it's his fault that he wasn't man enough to save his daughter. Wow, a lot to unpack here. Very 2008, I feel like, morality-wise and masculinity-wise. Like, homie.
I just, like, I can't understand who we are supposed to be rooting for, because I feel like in every story they're supposed to be rooting for someone, right? So mm-hmm. It's like at the beginning, we, you know, the wife is all like, don't wear that tie. Hold on, pause, quick pause. This would be a great time to play our theme song. Hello, listeners. Welcome to Wheels Up. It's a Criminal Minds podcast. My name is James.
And I'm Bea. And this week we are talking season 4, episode 11, Normal, directed by Steve Boyum and written by Andrew Wilder.
Okay, great. Out of the way. Back to
what I was saying. One thing before we move on? I know we want to actually like get into talk about this episode because, wow, what an episode. I just want to say that Steve Boyum directed only a little bit of Criminal Minds. What are the two episodes do you think that he directed in season 4? It's this episode and one other.
The other car episode.
The other car episode. Why does this man keep getting the car episodes? Is he just like a car
he's
guy?
He's good at it. I mean, he's good at it.
And they know that? Like, what is it?
The scenes in the car were great.
I mean, great job, Steve Boyum. But also, you like just a car guy?
Niche.
I don't know. That's
niche
his niche.
Director, yeah. Fast and Furious.
Don't get me fucking started.
Okay, so I just, you know, it starts off with like the wife being like, don't wear that stupid tie. Also, don't forget to put the seat down. And then like he sees the blonde being bossy to him and he shoots her. And I was just like, sorry, is this an episode about, like, bossy blondes pushing him to his limit? And now he has to, like, prove his masculinity, but he does that, like, in a violent way, which is bad? Like, is it, like, his method is bad, but the women also shouldn't have pushed him too far? Like, that's the message I'm getting from this, is, like, the women in his life were domineering and he retaliated in a very bad way, but like it makes sense that he reached his breaking point. That's the message I'm getting.
But like also at that point, then you're just blaming the victims of these terrible crimes.
I know.
The fact that this dude committed crimes.
I know, and I hate that, but like that's the message I'm getting from this. Especially because they go to the hotel, the hospital, and the woman is like, normally I would never be mean, but like I called him a woman, and then he shot me, and it's like, the woman made it personal. That's what Hutch says, she made it personal. Like, no, like, people can be assholes, and that doesn't mean you get to shoot them. Like
that's pretty much a very pivotal part of society is somebody being minorly mean to you and you not being able to shoot them in the fucking face.
Also, in what world is somebody driving that aggressively and you pull up next to them and your instinct is, I should talk to them?
Literally, what? Honestly, it must be like the fucking male audacity. Truly.
The second, like, I got why he was, like, first off, he was driving so slow. Like, I would never have swerved the way that she did. I'm not a honker. I just would have been silently pissed in my own car. Mm-hmm. But I would have been pissed. I would have been behind him, like, it's okay to go 3 over the speed limit.
You can go five over.
Actually. Half the time I'm in my car, I'm like, if we could just go the speed limit, I would be happy.
I would be fucking delighted.
I'm like on the highway, like if we could just go 55, like if you could just hit 55, I'll shut up. Like, but
if we can tag team this to hit 55 right now, bestie, yeah. I'd be delighted.
If we could just go the speed limit, I would be so happy with that. But like, yeah, silently rage in your own car. Like, so she pulls around him, which is crazy. And she's like on her fucking, okay, I did write down. She says, like, my son plagiarized an essay and like, I was about to get to commission. And she says, if I lose this commission, it's coming out of his college fund.
The subplot of this child, this like teen boy plagiarizing, making his mom come to the school and then having her get in a life-altering car wreck so he feels guilty about it forever is crazy.
What a first off, I was like, she's a bitch. Like, this is not a normal reaction. Like, I get it. Like, she's a single mom who works two jobs, loves her kids. No, just kidding. She's like a hot shot Orange County real estate boss babe and like single mom and her son's plagiarizing. Blah. And I was like, yeah, I would call my friend and bitch about it too. Like, there's nothing wrong with like her attitude, like sucks. But also if like I was about to close this big deal and make this big commission as a single mother and I get a call that my son, I have to go to his school because he plagiarized an essay. Hell yeah, I'm calling my sister and bitching about it the whole time.
No, for real. Like, I get it. I'm with her.
And there's no telling. She probably wouldn't have walked into that school like, let him go. Because we know she's upset because she's like, if I lose this commission, it's coming out of his college fund. Why did he plagiarize a fucking essay? Like, she shouldn't have been driving like that. But it's not like, it doesn't seem like a bad person.
Yeah. And then, like, later on, when they're in the hospital and her son is there, he's, like, really sweet and protective of her. I'm like, this child is so traumatized, but also he's going to be the best person in the world from now on.
Yes. Like, and but the fact that she's like, I normally never even honk. I was just, like, really annoyed and I was in a rush. And also, from what I've heard about driving in California, this is an acceptable reaction to how it is to drive in California.
Driving in California is a special kind of hell, I believe.
Yeah. But the thing is,
I think it's
like
the sixth ring, maybe?
All I can think, but think about it from her perspective, right? She's having this shitty day. She's stuck behind the slowest moving guy. And she's like, I need to get to the school so that I can go back to work and close the deal. So she's like, I'm just going to go around him. Also, it is a two-lane merge.
It's two lanes. They pull up beside each other at the stoplight.
Like, there's nothing wrong with going around somebody. Like, yeah, sure, she passed him on the right. That's not correct. But also, like, he's in the left crawling. Like, if I'm in a two-lane, two lanes, specifically with, so that we have the ability to pass each other. That's what that's for.
Yeah.
And she passes him. She just does it like fast after honking. And then I'm there at the light. I'm having this shitty ass day. I did a totally faster than I should have, but a totally normal road move. And he rolls down his window and is like, excuse me, roll, hand gesture. I roll down the window and I go, look, bud, I'm busy. You drive like a grandma. And then I roll it back up and go back to what I'm doing with my life. Like, yeah, I probably didn't leave a great impression on this guy, but also like, not the worst in the world.
Like a normal reaction to having a bad day. Sometimes shit sucks, bestie. Like, damn. Yeah.
She's also, like, on a phone call. And she, like, went around him. She wasn't going to do anything. He changed lanes so that he would pull up beside her. So that he could... He's being the Karen in this situation. I drove really slow.
He's continuing the situation.
He's like, I drove really slow. Somebody passed me. And now I need to say, excuse me, you shouldn't have passed me in the lane made for passing. Like, I would be like, hey, bud, sorry you drive so slow, but, like, I have somewhere to be. And then I go back to my phone call that I'm on. Like, that's not...
It's crazy unreasonable.
And then I'm paralyzed from the waist down for the rest of my life. And my son has to be like, I plagiarized a high school essay. Like, it's not even, like... I mean, don't plagiarize. I'm very anti. But also, like... Like, he copy and pasted from a source for a high school essay. Like, it's not a life of crime here. He's like, oh no, I didn't change enough words from the Wikipedia article. And now my mother is paralyzed from the waist down probably forever.
This kid subplot, this kid is going through like some fucking Silent Hill ass shit. And it's like crazy.
And then we find out that she's a single mother. So, like, she's paralyzed now as a... She's his only parent.
Like, it's crazy! It's fucking nuts! I feel so bad for this woman and her son!
I know! And her car, like... I'm sorry, he should have gone and made a fucking, like, Reddit post about this. Right? Like, put it on your blog. Not a shotgun?
Well, he already had done the shotgun to the family at this point, so I
guess... No, he hadn't. It's that night.
Really?
I know, yeah. So I can actually give you the timeline for this. I know it because I'll tell you why. So, he shoots this woman. And then he's all like, I'm the life of the party. I'm cool now. And he's talking to people. He's toasting. The wife is like, oh my God, Norm, you're being so, like, nice. And then they have sex. His pajamas are those ones that look like a suit, but they're like silk pajamas.
He's got that butch pajama set on.
They had just had sex and he was still in his full pajamas. Is that like a straight people thing? Just pull your pajamas out of the way enough to do sex and then become fully dressed again. What is that? Ew. I would love to feel my wife's body against my own for the intimacy of it all. Why are you in a suit? This
man? No.
I know. So anyway, he gets up, he sits up, and he puts on, it's called a dressing gown, you know, the big robe. He puts on his big robe. Coat. Yeah, and then he goes and he like walks up to each one of his daughter's rooms and then goes downstairs and saws off the shotgun. And then he goes back upstairs and shoots them all. That's the timeline.
Really? Okay, so it's after he saws off the shotgun.
Yeah, because when you see it in the flashback at the end, one, he's wearing that dressing gown.
But I thought that was noticed. Just like another night that he like...
No, because he has... Remember, because this... Okay, first of all, the shotgun is in a gift box for who?
For his wife, I guess?
It's her promotion party.
So you're giving her a shotgun?
For her promotion... Why is that? Whatever. That's never explained. I hate it. Anyway, also he gift wrapped the box so that the bottom is wrapped and the and top the lid is wrapped
separately. Gift wrapped it like you do on TV. It's so funny.
I was
going to say,
I hate when this is a television thing.
Oh, no, for sure. It's for sure is.
With the, like, I cannot think of a single time I've ever been given a gift that I don't have to, like, unwrap. This is a gift you don't have to unwrap. This is an, I will be using the same gift box for every gift, so I'm wrapping it once.
Honestly, kind of real, though.
I mean, I guess so, yeah. But here
but
he has
it
this
is
gun.
Specifically a TV yeah. thing, so they don't have to yeah. reset gifts on
no,
Christmas
absolutely.
Episodes.
No, absolutely. But anyway, he shoots her the first time. Remember they say the gun is different the first time? It's because he hasn't sawed it off yet. But in the flashbacks, it's sawed off.
Okay, I did not catch that.
Yeah, so he gets up, he puts his dressing gown on, he goes downstairs, he saws off the shotgun, he goes upstairs, he kills his two children and his wife. And then, okay, here's my question, though. Days, okay, 3 weeks pass. It's like one a week. Is he sleeping in the bed beside his decomposing wife?
I don't know if he's back at that house because they all make
Where
like,
else is
faces.
He staying?
They all make like faces when they walk in, like because the smell is overpowering.
Well, because they've been dead for like a month.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like, where is he living then?
Does he just like chill in his little like man cave downstairs? Does he just sleep in the garage?
I mean, maybe he like literally can't smell it because he's like in this delusion he's having.
That could be.
Yeah. But like in the first time when he walks up and he like walks up to Brittany's room and he doesn't go in. And then he walks up to Sasha's room and he doesn't go in. He's actually going in and shooting them. We just don't see it because he's like disassociated from that. So that's
also
the thing.
Can I ask?
Yeah.
Is everybody like one bad day away from taking a shotgun to your most cherished family members? Like what? This dude has other issues for sure, right?
I think this, okay, this is one of those episodes that really makes me like, I don't know about this one, guys. Because, like, his daughter dies. Tragic, of course.
Tragic event.
6 months have passed. And he has decided that his wife doesn't care anymore. Because he says that at the end. He's like, she says, I cry every day. And he's like, that doesn't count as grieving our daughter. Like what has happened? Like, I don't know. Like, his wife,
I don't know
like,
about this one, gang.
His daughter died 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. I just feel like 6 months is like a long time between like.
That's like half a year.
Yeah, between like the tragedy and the. Like what is I guess the secondary this would have been an episode to talk about a secondary stressor where the secondary stressor is his wife's promotion.
That's what would make sense to me, right? But like so he shoots that lady on his way to his wife's party.
Wife's promotion
as
party,
sort
yeah.
of a way of reasserting control over his life because he feels like he yeah. is incompetent, and so he's like, fuck it, I'll shoot somebody, I'll be yeah. competent, whatever. Yeah. They bang that night.
Yeah.
And then he shoots all of his family members. He shoots his two other daughters and his wife.
Yeah. And then continues going to work every day for a month. But also, like he's a, like, I think the way that he can get away with it.
What about the kids at school?
What about the kids at school? We know the wife took, the boss later says that the wife took a few weeks off of work, like, to celebrate. So, like, it makes sense.
She got a promotion. Sure.
Right. But I don't know. Also, they work in the same place, but like he's in charge of corporate expenses, like business expenses. He's in charge of
like
expenses.
The travel accounts, as they say.
Yeah, travel accounts. Yeah, that's not like a nothing position. And
it's crazy to me that this guy only has a cubicle when he is like some sort of senior vice president of accounting. Like, it's crazy to me.
Yes. Like, he has this job, like, this whole job, and so she gets a promotion. We have no idea what she does, but she's, like, taking calls and, like, working from home. She's a home office, you know, so she's, like, boss babe. But he, I guess, resents that. This is an episode that assumes the audience will pick up all of the subtle social like cues, the unspoken things. Like, we're supposed to watch this and be like, oh, he's mad that she has a better paying position. He's mad that she is working so hard after the kid died when he's affected. Like, oh, I understand why, because she's like telling him what to do. That would make any husband mad. Like, it feels like they're banking on the target demographic understanding exactly why this guy has reacted so intensely to his situation without them having to actually
say it,
put any of that out there. Yeah.
I also think it kind of banks on the audience being as enriched in like the patriarchy and misogyny as this episode is. Like, yeah. It feels like it's like the core demographic for the show, right, was like middle-aged people who watch CBS at night. That's like my parents, right?
Exactly.
And I think like they would get it. But also I think as we keep going, exactly, like as we keep going further away from this very specific moment in time, and as mm-hmm. we as queer people watch this episode, and yeah. I watch this episode and have a very different relationship with masculinity than this man yes. does, it's like crazy. Like it feels like it falls apart so badly, especially later mm-hmm. on when they start talking about like masculinity crises and whatever. And I'm like, I know so many people who do masculinity wildly different than this man in crisis.
I think this is an episode that it's like good for us to have hit this episode, because I feel like it's reminding us that like we're not Criminal Minds' target demographic.
We're for sure not Criminal Minds' target demographic, for sure.
And I think it's really interesting, like, as a queer person, as somebody with a spouse, as a younger generation than the target demographic, you know, the signifiers and, you know, stuff that they're using is not in our frame of reference. This is a man and a wife from a very specific period of time in mm-hmm. American history. Mm-hmm. Like, this is like watching a museum piece.
It kind of is, in a funny way. It's just so specific, and it's so funny to me that everybody in the world is like, these are such entrenched ideals. And then you and I are like, I don't know why this man murdered his family with a shotgun. Like, truly makes yeah. no sense to me. Like,
it's really interesting to me. Like, here's the thing about this episode. I don't need to know anything about this family.
Sure.
I don't need to know the backstory. I don't need to know the situation. All I need to know is that this man is a middle-aged white man who expected to be head of household,
mm-hmm.
expected his daughters to respect him, expected his wife to let him be the breadwinner, and instead he has a teenage daughter who is approaching womanhood and he can't relate. He has a preteen daughter who is surly and disrespectful like every preteen girl in the world. And he has a wife who is getting promotions and moving up in the work hierarchy while he has a cubicle. And that is enough for him to feel like he is not getting what he deserves from his job and from his family. And then when he gets told by a woman, another blonde woman, all of his daughters are blonde.
They do a lot of really great visual storytelling with that family. Yes. And the fact that all of those daughters look exactly like their mother is so, yes. like, it's uh-huh. just like such a great piece of visual storytelling.
Absolutely. And like the fact that this other blonde woman so later, remember there's a scene where he goes into the wife's office and she has the same Bluetooth that the woman in the car does. Mm-hmm. And she's talking on the phone, sounding just like the woman in the car. So when that woman, you know, so the guy's at home, he's having all this pressure. He's failing. He's not the breadwinner. He's not wearing the pants in the relationship. He's not making, you know, promotions. He's not making money moves. His children don't respect him. He's getting ready to go to his wife's promotion, wearing a tie with cars on him, which is clearly his hyperfixation. And his wife is like, hey, you can't wear that tie. It's kind of dumb. Also, please don't forget to put the seat down. You live in a house of entirely women. And he is already feeling less than. Like, that hurts him. She doesn't like his tie. She doesn't like his interest. She doesn't get it. And now he has to go to her promotion party and make nice with all these people watching as his wife is a better business person than he is getting promoted and he's not. And on the way, while he's dreading all of this, a woman who looks like his wife is talking on the phone like his wife, looks at him and says, "You drive like a grandmother. Like, get out of the left lane." And he's like, "Oh, I am once again being disrespected. I can't do this. I'm a man. Respect me." And he shoots her.
It's, like, functionally crazy.
It's crazy. And it is like a museum piece at this point. Because it's just like, there was a period of time where people would watch this episode and the wife would look at the husband and be like, "Now don't you shoot me the next time I remind you to put the toilet seat down." You know, there'd be a time where a husband is like, "Ah, oh, sometimes I want to shoot you too." Like, this would be like a funny episode to people, I think, in the target demographic at that time.
Yeah. It's just functionally such a fucking crazy episode because it feels so, like, if you just take the steps to, like,
yeah,
negate one or two of those, like, quote-unquote inherent symbols, it just, like, falls apart completely.
Like, if this man... Okay, also, one thing that, like, big red flag for me is you live in a house of entirely women and you have for 17, 20 years... And you don't put the seat down when you're done in
literally
the bathroom?
Get your shit together, my man. It's not that hard.
Well, not just that, but, like, that shows a level of, like, he's inconsiderate.
Yeah.
Like, everybody else in your house needs the toilet seat down. And yet, you are unwilling to make this one concession to make their lives easier. And also, you have to have the seat down to poop. There's one person who does one body function in this house that needs the toilet seat up. Like, yeah, just put it down. That's the nice
thing.
Just
put it down. Babe,
you know?
Put it down.
And like also, it's very interesting, his like man cave with all those cars that he builds and he paints, and that fact that there's so many of them tells me that he's not very connected with his family. Like, tragedy aside, he clearly spends all of his free time alone in the basement building these cars. Like, of course you don't have a relationship with your children. Of course they don't respect you. They don't know you.
Also, like, I feel like a little bit that while we're sort of talking about his, like, wild family dynamic, it's also, like, the child who died was, like, what, 5, maybe?
6, yeah. Super
5,
young.
6. At that age, she was probably the apple of his fucking eye. And she was probably the one who was trying to, like, engage with him and the one who was down in the basement with him playing with the cars while he painted them. Like, he couldn't even move to save the one daughter who, like, gave a shit about him. Sorry to these other daughters. They didn't deserve this either. But, like, you know what I mean? Like, that sort of... The, like, angelic little one is even the one who he couldn't save. Like, it's crazy.
She gets out of the car because she's like, "I want to help you. You know, I'll help you with the little car, so let me help you with the big car." And he doesn't move. Like, I have no sympathy for this man, and I have no sympathy for men like this.
Mm-hmm.
At the time period, you know, 2008, I was, like, 13. But, now, especially, like, as an adult with a partner, like, even without a partner, if you've ever had a roommate, you know, like, it's not a lot of effort, you know, to be considerate. Mm-hmm. And, like, he had a kitchenette down there. Like, does he just take his meals there? Like, how much time is he really spending with his family? And then he expect, like, you don't just get respect for no reason.
But he should, because he's the man of the house.
Exactly. And I think this episode, like episodes before it, doesn't do a clear job of telling us how we're supposed to feel about this man. Are we supposed to be like, yeah, he's the man of the house, they should respect him just because he's their father and the husband, and it's a tragedy that his wife is you know, getting promoted and he's not? Or are we supposed to recognize that, like, his insecurity and the violence he enacts because he is feeling emasculated is why he is weak as a man? You know, I don't know how Criminal Minds wants me to feel about this. Am I supposed to be like, be a bigger man, fuck your wife more, and take your daughters to the ball game? Or are we supposed to be like, yeah, they should just respect him because he's the father and the husband? I don't know how Criminal Minds is, I don't know what they're saying.
It's also like, his wife?
Smoke show.
Smoke show, number one. Number two. Number one, way out of his league. Number two, did, like, in the time we saw her, was like a normal person. She wasn't like especially telling him off or anything. She wasn't, she was just like, hey, this is my work party. That's not my favorite tie of yours. She didn't say to change it. I mean, the implication she was there, but like.
Well, she was like, you're not going to wear that, are you? Yeah. Like, wear a better tie. Which, like, it's her party. Like, when
it's
I go to my wife's.
Work party.
Yeah, and you also work there. But, like, it's her promotion party. Like, when my wife takes me to things, I let her. I mean, you know, I pick my outfit. But if she's like, oh, no, that jacket isn't right for this, I'll be like, okay, you know, it's your party.
Exactly. Like.
And yeah, then I don't know.
Later, she's like actively on the phone trying to talk while he's just looming in the doorway. Like, yeah, I'm going to shut the door then. I'm fucking busy, dude.
And the daughter is also on the, which I think the daughter being on the phone and the wife being on the phone is, you know, a parallel there. But she's on the phone and he just opens the door and stares at her. And she's literally like, what? Like, what? You came into my room.
Sir.
You,
what?
You came into my room without knocking. I'm on the phone and you are staring at me like a serial killer. What, Dad? I'm 17. Like,
yeah, it's just this episode very much feels like a relic of a very specific type of misogyny that still exists. Mm-hmm. Sure. But also, if you are not straight, and you are queer and you have a different relationship with masculinity, this episode hits way different. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it absolutely hits different. And, ugh, it's a rough one. So we mostly talked about this first section. Her car goes flat. He shoots her and her car, like,
ass over tea
launches.
Kettle. Just goes.
Just flying. And he's hanging out. They do the sex. He gets up and puts on his gown. He, like, doesn't go to anyone's room. His daughter's name is Jenny. And I was like, I miss Jenny. Jiro.
Well, we see her in this episode.
I know, at the end. Okay. Oh, I do have something to say. So he's using a sawed-off shotgun.
Sure.
That's illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is, in the 1930s, the National Firearms Act basically was trying to make it harder for people to own what's called criminal guns, or guns that have no use outside of crime. And they couldn't just, like, you literally can't make it illegal to buy guns, right? Second Amendment. But they, sure, what they did is, in order to get a permit, it was like $200 to get a permit to, like, have a concealable pistol. They just made it, like, financially crippling, basically. Mm-hmm. And so they included shortened rifles and shortened shotguns, things, you know, guns that could still be concealed, because they didn't want people to buy, like, a shotgun without the $200 tax and then just, like, saw it down to wear it. But then later, the pistol was removed, but the shotguns and the rifles, the shortened ones, were still, they're still illegal to have without the proper permit. You need the permit from the ATF, which is taxed about $200. And it's also interesting, though, because sawed-off shotguns aren't more accurate. They're less accurate because it's truly just, like, buckshot in every direction.
Truly,
right?
Yeah, you've taken away what little aiming mechanics a shotgun had.
Yeah, and you see at one point on the car, it is just like the spread.
Truly,
Of, you know, buckshot and whatever the fuck it is when it's not for hunting. But it's just interesting that it's purely for crime. That's a gun for crime. You don't have a sawed-off shotgun unless you want a powerful gun to hide for crime.
To do crime.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why it's illegal. I just wanted to put that out there. He started sawing off the shotgun, and I was like, that's illegal, sir. Like, he's not a serial killer.
Like, that's going to stop him? Real?
Hey, you can't do that. That's $200. You need a permit for that.
That's illegal.
Hey, get a permit for that. It's like, it's illegal. No BAU before the opening. It's been a while.
Huh. It was just him. Yeah.
It was just the opening. It was just setting up his mental, emotional state, his family situation, what his crime was, the sawing it off to be better at it, who his victim type is, what triggers him, opening. And I like that. I enjoy that.
It's been a hot minute.
Yeah. Okay. We're on the plane. Jordan sits next to Emily, and they're sitting very close together. But I did write that Jordan never looks directly at Emily, and Emily is, like, leaned super far away, and Jordan is, like, sitting forward and, like, not sitting beside her. So I was kind of like, did they break up?
This is a rough episode for Jordan, I think, just, like, in general. I think she was just having a bad day.
She was having a bad day, and then it just got worse. You know what she didn't do, though? Shoot multiple people with a shotgun.
Okay.
I mean, I'm just saying.
Just saying.
I'm just saying. Okay, the blonde woman has survived the crash. Okay, wait. We need to be introducing actors as we go, because there's a lot of them.
There are so many, like, star-studded actors in this episode for what?
Okay, so Norman is played by Mitch Pileggi, who's Skinner from The X-Files.
I've never watched, like, The X-Files, so that's, like, not crazy to me, but, like, damn, that's fucking nuts. His IMDb page says he has so many episodes of The X-Files.
Yeah, he's Scully and Mulder and Scully's boss.
Oh, for real?
Yeah, he's, like, the boss of them. Like, the actual FBI guy, assistant director of the FBI. Yeah, no, he's famous. He's famous.
He's famous.
Yeah, this is, like, right after The X-Files movie came out.
He's
crazy.
Also, according to his IMDb page, the only actor besides David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson that appears in all X-Files properties.
That's what I'm telling you, yeah.
Fun fact. Big...
And then he's in Criminal Minds as this guy, which is very funny. And then, name the woman who got shot.
Elaine Hendricks, who is probably best known to us for playing the stepmom in The Parent Trap.
I literally, or like the girlfriend, because I don't think they ever got married, but... Whatever. I literally was like, oh my God, is that the woman? I was like, there's no way that's the woman from The Parent Trap. It is.
And it is.
It is. And then the wife is
played by Faith Ford, who
is in Murphy Brown.
She's Murphy Brown, sure. I know that she's the wife from The Pacifier, which is a bad 2005 movie with Vin Diesel in it that I watched so goddamn much. Truly so much.
He's like a spy, right? Or something. Like a military man who's babysitting.
Okay. The plot of The Pacifier is that he is a Navy SEAL who fails to rescue a scientist who was making some sort of device. And so he, as sort of penance for failing to rescue the scientist, goes to protect the scientist's family while the scientist's wife, Julie Plummer, played by Faith Ford, goes to, like, settle up their affairs and, like, help clean out, like, the scientist's, like, lab and shit, right? So he has to babysit all of these annoying-ass kids, including Brittany Snow, from, like, a very pre-Pitch Perfect era. This movie was fucking stacked for no good reason. Anyway, he has to parent all of them and also direct the Sun's musical theater production of the Sound of Music, and also has to rescue these children from enemy spies who are trying to break into their house to find the science object from their dad. It is a buck wild movie. I've watched it too many times, but it's very fun to me. If you want like a good like movie you can put on, if you're like having to babysit like your baby cousin or something, Vin Diesel's put on this The Pacifier. Movie about babysitting. Go for it.
Yeah. Okay. So the blonde robot has survived the crash. She's paralyzed from the waist down. There have been two more victims since then, and the last one was killed a week ago. So this has been happening for like 2 or 3 weeks now. And they get the victims can only describe him as a normal middle-aged white guy. Sorry, the victim. The second and the third ones were fully killed. So the woman from the parent trap can only describe him as like a normal middle-aged white guy. And Jordan is like, isn't that consistent with trauma? And Emily's like, no, you either remember everything or you remember nothing. Which I don't know is true.
I don't think that's entirely supported by science anymore.
No, because I feel like there's a lot of, like, especially with, like, something like sexual assault or something like that, trauma like that, you tend to, like, focus on one thing while you are disassociating. You know, like, it smelled like cigarettes or the ground was really hard or, like, there, your mind picks, like, one thing that is not the trauma to focus on. And I feel like that's where we are right now in terms of traumatic incidents. Also, like, I think it makes sense that she's like trying to, like, there's nothing interesting about this guy to remember.
That's the whole point, is he's just some dude.
Yeah. And so I think that's outdated. Anyway, so the reason the BAU didn't get the call until now is because until this third victim, they didn't know if they were connected or not, which is crazy to think that there are just three people driving around shooting other drivers with shotguns.
It like, seems if you think they're too separate. Specific, really.
Yeah, but like it was different cars every time, and the first gun was different. And then Rossi's like, it's the same gun. He sawed off a shotgun. He's evolving, and quickly.
I love the way Rossi stands up to deliver those pictures and then the line and then just sits back down again.
He could have just like
stands up to get a real good toss onto the table and then he's like, all right, and I'm done.
And I'm sitting again. Yeah. And they've named him the Road Warrior.
Yeah.
Which is very Mad Max of you, I guess.
Very Mad Max.
And they're like, this is the hardest kind of guy to catch because it's totally impersonal. And there are, okay, Derek says there are three parts to the crime scenes. One, his car, which is gone with him. Two, the victim's car, which is wrecked. And three, the road, which is like immediately contaminated with other cars.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like really hard because there's kind of nothing except it's a shotgun. And they're all blonde, you know. Cut to the sheriff's office task force. It's Gina Torres.
Gina goddamn Torres is in this episode.
I literally paused it to be like, Gina Torres? Famous from Firefly, Suits, a million other things. Beautiful.
The Matrix, Reloaded, and Revolutions?
Yes. Yes, that's true. I love her. She's beautiful. Great. They get there. Jordan does her introductions. All the vehicles from the crashes are there. They're in like some sort of warehouse. And Derek, Emily, and Hotch go to look at the cars. Jordan is like, I'm going to go talk to the media and figure out a press conference. And Gina Torres is like, we are on tech alert. The helicopters are doing 24/7 freeway patrol. Where everything you need to know is in this room. Blah, blah. Nothing solid on the tip line. It's all amateur crime fighters and old people, she says.
That's us. We're the amateur true crime besties. That's us, yeah, actually. That's us. We're on
is
the
this
tip line.
Play about us. Sometimes I just think about Elias's monologue. And I'm like, it's this fucking play about us.
I think about it so often. God. Somebody from Criminal Minds, please come onto this show. Criminal Minds writers room, producers, background
Anybody.
Actors, please come onto this show.
I have some questions.
I have some questions. Was that fucking play about us? Was that play about us?
There are several other Criminal Minds podcasts, some of which are like fancy and famous and actually get real people to talk to.
Sure. And we are and gay.
And we are gay. Okay. There's nothing solid on the tip line. And Rossi is like, how is there nothing solid on the tip line? And Gina Torres says, Orange County has an endless supply of three things. Freeways, news coverage, and blonde female luxury car owners. And they're like, oh, really? Like, can you get help then? And she says, I could ask for a submarine and get it.
Which is, I think, maybe the hardest line that has been said by a guest detective in this show.
Yeah.
I could ask for a submarine for my case about road rage and receive it. Damn! Okay, bitch!
I also feel like they keep talking about Orange County like I'm supposed to know what that implies.
L.A. people who live in L.A. love to think that everybody else also knows the intricacies of L.A. I do not. Orange County is just like one of many L.A. counties, by the way. It's not even like L.A. is not one county. It's like seven, yeah. Right?
I couldn't tell you. All I know is that I'm pretty sure there's a Real Housewives of Orange County.
There is. It's pretty good, actually.
And I'm pretty sure there's like a Sons of Anarchy type show set in Orange County.
Orange County covers not a lot of LA. It covers like South LA from like Disneyland and Huntington Beach down to like San Juan, Capistrano. Yeah.
Emily later will say, we need to shut down every alternating merge in the county. And I am from Miami-Dade County, which just that county has like 5 million people living in it.
Sure.
The idea, it takes an hour to drive from the bottom of my county. No, sorry. An hour and a half to drive from the bottom of my county to the top of my county. And when they said we need to shut down every alternating merge in the county, I was like, nobody's going to say that's an impossible task. Nobody's going to be like, that's too many. So I thought it must be a small county.
Well, not really, but also yes, kind of.
It's crazy to me that you can just be like, actually, every... Also, in a city like LA, the fact that they're like, go to every construction area and shut that shit down. Like, what?
Well, it's not every construction area. It's a very specific type of lane interchange that they're looking for, which isn't in every construction area. You know, they're looking for a specific merge pattern. And most construction areas, like, don't have, like, if it's only, like, 12 construction areas in the Orange County that have that specific merge pattern, that's not hard. You can call the safety supervisors on all of those in an hour.
That's fair. Okay. All right. Anyway,
it's just because they're looking for such a specific type, like every construction site is like a two-lane merger or whatever, where like it's an uncontrolled two lanes. Like there's nobody telling them to zipper merge. It's just like merging as you go.
Yeah.
Which is the worst way to run traffic, I think, ever.
Absolutely.
But it was 2008. We were dumb then.
It was still dumb. There's so many of those near me and I hate it. There's like a big street that runs, that's close by. And they have been, I mean, every time they like update a section, it's like, thank God they fixed it. But while it's being fixed, it's like
it's kind of the worst thing in the world.
It's like the worst half mile on the planet. And it's a very long road. And they just keep moving down it slightly, slightly, slightly. And every time I'm like, thank you for fixing all these potholes. Thank you for adding an extra lane. Thanks for the bike lane. I love it. And then I hit the next patch of road work and I'm like, fuck you. Fuck the city. But, you know,
they're adding a public transport line like two blocks away from me. And I'm like, God, it's going to be so nice once this public transport line is open, because then I won't have to drive on this road anymore. But while I have to drive on this road, fuck you. Fuck your mother. Like, fuck this shit.
Emily, Derek, and Hotch are by the cars and they're talking about the killings. And they say the first killing was different. It was a sunny day, the crowded freeway, all of that. And Emily is like, there's, you know, a lot of witnesses. That's, you know. You know, maybe he did it, like, spontaneously. I don't know. And Derek's like, yeah, he's a fast study, though, because he sawed off his shotgun. Now there's he's doing it at night, etc. And Emily's like, wait a minute, wait. What if the first time he just, like, did it? Like, he was triggered and he killed someone. And they're like, and Hutch says, well, if you're doing it, you know, unplanned, like, you might as well be in your own car. So they call this an SUV. Okay. They're like, the SUV is his. And then they're like, but then why would you have a shotgun in your car? Like, what made him...
Why did he have the shotgun in his car? I am always... Like, was he gonna kill his wife at that party?
Oh. Do you think he was bringing that shotgun to kill his wife at the party?
I don't know what other reason you buy someone a shotgun and you bring it to their work party.
And then he didn't take it out of the car. He didn't give her a present.
He didn't bring it inside.
After he shot it.
Was he going to shoot up his work? Because he almost does it later, when the manager is talking to him.
Was he planning on shooting up his job and instead he shot this woman and that, like, satisfied him? I like this theory. Unsubstantiated in the episode. Okay.
What other answer is there for the shotgun in the car?
Why did he have a shotgun in a gift box?
Like, yeah.
No, it makes no sense at all. Okay. Hotch and Emily are going to re-interview the woman from Parent Trap. They walk in, the son is defensive of her, and she's like, it's okay. And Emily takes the son out. And the woman is like, I'm a single mom. I'm just trying to, like, take care of my son. And they're trying to, like, piece it the day together, you know. And there's a flashback to her being angry. So when she insults him the first time, there's, like, a truck coming up behind and it drowns out the noise. We don't hear what she says. And so I don't know what that does, though. Like, we find out here. Like, what if we had just, like...
It's just
funny. I loved it. I assumed it was a bunch of curse words. I wonder if we're supposed to assume it's a bunch of curse words.
I think so. But also, I think when the truck comes up, his mouth also moves, and so you think he's saying something to her, but then the reveal is that he didn't say shit, it was all her yelling at him.
Oh, I see.
When you see them in profile, his mouth moves, but he just never gets a word in edgewise because she's yelling at him.
I think I didn't register the noise until it was clear that she was talking, I think is what happened. So maybe you're supposed to think that he was yelling at her.
Yeah, I think that's what you're supposed to think.
Okay, that makes sense. And she, you know, Hotch is like, did he swear at you? Did he honk at you? Did he threaten you? And she basically admits she was rude to him. Oh, here it was. She says, now you want to talk about your feelings like some chick? You drive like an old lady. And I wrote it's about the emasculation. And she says... He seemed so normal. Name of the episode.
They say normal so many times in this episode. I'm like, I get it.
Also, his name is Norman.
Yeah.
Which I was like, that's fun.
Really?
Yeah. And then she says, you know, I'm usually really nice in the car because you never know what someone's going to do. And then the first time she's rude, Hotch makes that, like, oh, face. She's just like... Well, okay. Emily's talking to the son. And the son is like, it's my fault. I got in trouble at school. Like, if it weren't for me, she wouldn't have even been in her car on the road that day. Which I think they say so that we know that it was unplanned. Like, she wasn't targeted or anything, followed. You know, she wouldn't have been there. And then the son goes back to taking care of her. And Emily's like, so what happened? And Hotch says, she made it personal. Which, like, no, she didn't. She just said
but she did call him a little bitch to his face.
But I just mean, like,
he took that personally.
I am not defending her misogyny, her, you know, anti-girls girl attitude. But being like, wait, you want to talk about your feelings like some chick? You drive like an old lady. How is she supposed to know that's his, like,
well, his trigger? Well, that's the point.
Know? Right.
Is that you never do.
She made it personal. Yeah. Okay. We're looking at maps of the task force. Reed is like, the victims are representing, like, a specific person to him, an ex-wife or a current wife, you know. But if he kills the wife, he loses the scapegoat. He loses, like, he can't be mad at her anymore. He can't blame her anymore because she's dead. Which I think is really interesting because, like, she is dead. He's just, like, having a psychotic break. And, but the women that he's killing remind him of his wife. So he's striking close to the focus of the resentment. And they're saying, okay, well, if the wife is the focus, the home is the focus. He probably lives, you know, in this area. And Reed asks about all these markers on the road. They're like triangles with numbers in them. And it's road work. And Reed's like, oh, shit, I just realized something. So Hotch is talking, and Hotch is like, you know, the woman made it a personal challenge. She insulted his manhood, so he had to reassert his manhood by shooting her in the face. And Reed comes in and is like, it's alternate merges. It's multiple lanes come down to like two lanes. So you merge one way or you merge the other way, and then yada yada. And this guy, he's probably driving through these merges over and over and over again until he gets cut off by somebody who is his type. And so Emily's like, I'm going to shut down every alternate merge in the county and talk to the crews. And then Hotch has this like monologue that is so dramatic.
What's up with Hotch this episode, man? He's really just like saying some shit. He's really having literally a silly, goofy time.
He's like, killers are like drug addicts. The first kill is the highest hit, and nothing else is going to make him feel the same way. But he's going to chase it until insanity and death. All he thinks about is killing. He begins to think he must be doing it wrong. He has to improve and hone his skills to get that high again. He needs to tailor his weapon to his deadly purpose. If he gets it perfect, then he'll get that first high. He's becoming a more lethal addict, and he will never accept that the high is gone. He's never going to stop. And while he's having this deadly deadly purpose monologue, the unsub is like building something, which is actually so smart. Mm-hmm. He builds this like two-prong attachment for the gun so that he can just like hook it over the edge of the window and it'll stay put, and he can re-cock, you know, the shotgun. He can do that on the window.
Pretty smart.
Make this guy an engineer. Stop killing things. Go be an engineer.
Stop killing people.
Stop killing. First off, stop killing people. Second of all, change.
Go be an engineer.
Yeah, go do something else. Hell yeah. Your wife's rich. She can pay your way for college. Okay. Hotch and Rossi and Gina Torres are talking to a construction guy. The guy is like, was some sort of safety officer, so he's the one holding the like slow stop, you know, sign. And he's like, this guy would have been driving in over and over again, extra slow. And the guy's like, oh my god, yeah, I remember it. I thought he was lost. And he says he was dressed like a hard ass, and then it cuts to Hotch. I was like, this show's funny.
This show's a comedy.
He's dressed like a hard ass, Hotch, but driving like a chick. And then he's like, no offense. And Gina Torres is like, none taken.
It's not like girl, girls, you can take some offense. That's all right.
It's not like girl's girl if you, Gina Torres. Okay. But the guy is wearing like a leather jacket and like mirrored sunglasses at night. And Hotch is like, he started role playing.
The horror with which he says he started role playing is so funny.
Do you remember in the first couple of seasons when Derek's whole thing was like role playing? I miss that.
Yeah. It was really funny. It was really funny. Let's not lie.
I miss when Derek used to role play.
I miss his role playing. Derek, come back, baby. Come role play again. Come climb through a window. Lay on the ground. Yell, maybe. Like, come on, baby.
The only thing I miss about Jason Gideon is when he was just like, okay, I'm the unsub.
Yeah, I really do miss that.
Oh, I miss it. Okay. And then we see, the construction guy is talking about how when a car cut him off, the unsub, he threw his arm across the street, almost like he's protecting somebody, but there's nobody there, which implies that, you know, he has kids. Okay, he drives a small SUV. It's a family vehicle. And the gesture to protect things means he's probably used to having somebody in the passenger seat. He's probably married with kids. And we have to hurry now because it's only a matter of time till he kills his whole family. We have to give the profile right now. Great. They're talking and they're like, he's having a masculine identity crisis. And Gina Torres is like, really a massive.
I love that Gina Torres is like, girl, be for real.
He's
be so,
so
serious
for real.
Right now, Aaron Hotchner.
Yeah.
Be so fucking for real.
Yeah. And there's like, there must have been a trauma that happened beforehand. He's in a psychotic break. The world around him has changed. His role in the family has changed. At home, he's less than a man. His children don't need or respect him. He is feeling unwanted and obsolete. He's delusional because it gives him purpose and makes him feel powerful. He'll die before he stops, you know, killing people. His home life and his fantasy cannot coexist. We have to find the car, set up an alternate merge, monitor it, and give a press conference. Great. Cut to Norman eating a sandwich at his desk. He's drinking milk out of a carton with a straw. He's kind of cute.
Really? I was going to say that's kind of loser behavior, TBH.
I was just like, oh, he's just like some guy with his little sandwich, his little milk.
With the straw, though?
Yeah, with the straw. Real men don't use straws. Fellas, is it gay to drink milk with a straw?
Fellas, is it gay to tenderly wrap your lips around a straw?
Fellas? What would you say it like that? Hey, fellas? A blonde woman comes over and is like, hey, Norman, can you, like, process this receipt? And he's like, I'm going to need approval. And she's like, yeah, sure, whenever you get around to it. The boss comes over. The boss plays the ex-husband from The Fosters. He's in The Fosters. That's the ex-husband from The Fosters, Mike.
Oh, really?
I looked at him and I was like, hold on. That's another guy who's very well known now. Yeah, he's in The Fosters. Yeah, Ally. Okay. The boss comes over and is like, hey, I need this summary, you know, corporate's really asking for it. And, you know, they say that, like, young people cost less than old people and, like, blah, 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 blah. And then Norman has, like, a fantasy of the boss, like, leaning over his shoulder being like, you're so fucking stupid, Norman. You're so goddamn bald, Norman.
You're fucking stupid and bald.
You're so fucking stupid. You can't even give me a
dumb and bald.
Fucking a spreadsheet, Norman. You're like, your spreadsheet's Norman. Great. And then Norman almost like pulls out the shotgun at work. I was like,
this is why I think maybe he was planning on doing a work shooting earlier.
I don't think you're wrong.
Okay.
I think that we really could have gotten like a workplace shooting.
I feel like he doesn't.
I don't know why they didn't.
There's no other reason for that to be in the car. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think you're right. Again, though, they don't substantiate it, but I think you're right. I think you're right, B.
Thanks.
So, you're welcome. And so the boss is like, Norman, I'm just trying to help you. Just trying to help you out, Norm. Great. Jordan is giving a press conference, and Norman, like, sees it on the TV, and everyone at work is watching it. And it, like, describes a normal white guy. He has a wife. He drives this car. Here's where he lives. He's had some sort of personal trauma. And then he hallucinates the blonde coworker calling him an emasculated loser. And he's
get his
like,
ass. Get him again.
Get his ass. Then he's again. Like thinking about all the guns or whatever. And then it said he recently suffered a personal trauma. This is before we knew about Jenny. So, but I guessed Jenny.
You called it?
I called it. Because he kept going up to Jenny's room and like putting his hand on it and then walking away again. And I was like, I bet it's Jenny. I bet Jenny's dead. Norman leaves work. And so, okay, this is the connection that I made. He's at the stop sign and he's hitting the seat next to him. So, like, it makes me think of, like, if he threw his arm out to protect them and now he's hitting the seat, throwing his arm out not to protect, but to, like, almost as if he's punching whoever would be in the seat next to him, like his wife. That's what I think. And then, yeah. And then the two guys pull up next to him and they're like, hey, are you okay? But then he has a fantasy where they're, like, laughing at him and I wrote, uh-oh. And then he pulls out the gun and he fires like every bullet he has in the shotgun.
How many shotgun shells were in that shotgun? I thought it just looked like a double barrel one to me.
I think it's like, it's not.
He like fires like six though.
I think it's like six. I think it's like four to or six. But yeah, I think it has a magazine. This one does. Not like the ones you have to put the bullets in every time. I think this one has a bit of a magazine. But shotgun mm-hmm. shells are big because they're all, like, scattershot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Cut to the cops are there. The guys that died, there's no warrants. They work in the area. It's the same gun and the same car and all that, but that's a different MO. It's daytime. It's his own vehicle. You know, he shot out the door, driver's door instead of the passenger door. And they were like, what time did this happen? 2:20. The press conference was at 2 o'clock. So, like, clearly it triggered him. And they're like, okay, so it only took 2 minutes for him to get here, but, like, based on the time of day and yada yada, suit, he probably works in the area. So they have, like, a 10-mile radius. And Derek calls Garcia to highlight a 10-mile radius and to, like, call them and coordinate with Prentice and Reed. This comes to another thing. Great. I think we just needed Garcia in the episode at least once.
She needed to keep that SAG card.
Yeah.
And I love that for her.
I do. Her contract says every episode, baby. Great. Jordan, like, appears and is like, was it because of me? And Hotch is like, absolutely not. You are not doing this here. And he, like, pulls her over and is like, what the fuck is your problem, basically? And she's like, was it because of me? Did I do this? Yada, yada. And he's like, can you do this job? And she's like, damn right I can do it. And he goes, good. You got another press conference. Let's go. Oh, fuck.
Like, damn, give her a break.
I know. So we get another press conference. It's just additional information. The profile. There's a smaller circle now within the big red one. There's the black one of, like, this is where he works. And we cut to him, like, at home. So, okay. We, like, splits in half. So we're going to go back and we're going to be jumping around a bit. She's like, anybody, can you call? You know, and one last thing. He needs to be held, you know, to account for what he's done. But he's also a husband and a father. He must be capable of some degree of mercy and compassion. Like, please don't hurt anybody else. Please turn yourself in. And I wrote, was that her or the team? Like, was that Hotch being like, ask him to turn himself in? Or was she straight up like, I have to ask him not to kill anybody else because I can't handle it? They don't really, like, make that clear, but I just had that question.
It reminds me a lot of later this season. Doesn't JJ have something similar where she's pleading with the guy to turn himself in?
We can't talk about that. Spoilers.
Okay.
Yes, but we can't talk about it anymore than that. That's next season.
Is that next season? Okay. Yeah. I just didn't know if that was this season, if they were kind of like...
No, I'm pretty sure it's next season.
All right. Cool.
Yeah, but after that, spoilers. Okay. Norman's walking around, and I wrote, he almost looks like he's gonna turn himself in. He goes over to his wife, and he's like, I'm the road warrior. I'm the shooter. And the wife is like, okay, Norman, and I'm the Zodiac killer. And she starts laughing, and she tells the daughters, and they're both like, oh my god, you're such a dork. Great. Reed has a call. Derek, Emily and Derek are, like, helping with the tip line. And Reed's on the phone, and Derek goes over to Emily and is like, hey, how's it going? And Emily goes, bruh.
You have She's just no... like, I hate this so much.
She says, you have no idea how many middle-aged white men have somebody in their life who thinks they're a serial killer.
Which is so funny. And then immediately Reed turns around and he's like, I've got something. Like, it's like, she's just complaining, and then Reed's like, don't worry, guys, I've got the one white guy who is a serial killer.
I figured it out.
So funny.
No, it's so funny. And they might have something, and it's the boss from earlier. And the boss is like, yeah, Norman's in charge of company expenses. He has access to the whole fleet of company cars, which is like how he's been switching cars up at night. And then they show a picture of him with his family. Did he suffer a tragedy? Yeah, he was changing a tire, and his daughter came out of the car and got hit. Great. That was 6 months ago. They get his personnel file. And this is where we find out that he has two files because his wife also worked here. She just got a promotion and then she, you know, took a couple weeks off to, like, celebrate. Cool. Norman at home. He walks into the room where his wife and his kids are and he's like, get in the car right fucking now. And they start driving super fast. And the wife is like, slow down, Norman, slow down. And he's like, we gotta get out of here. Flying around, doing a bunch of shit. Family's terrified. He blows a stop sign. Surprise, cop. Great. And then, as the daughters are like, Dad, stop, he's like, this is family business. Gina Torres gets a phone call about the chase.
Gina Torres.
Gina Torres, I love
Can her. We just stop a moment and be like, wow, Gina Torres.
She's so pretty.
She's so pretty. They have her in sort of like almost like the Derek Morgan fits of like the Henleys that are like thin the purple. And then like the jeans, the purples.
They're I'm in like okay, matching slay. Colors. Yeah. And she like has her ponytail at one point, and I'm just like, so true.
God, so true. Anyway, sorry.
Anyway. Derek, Emily, and Reed are closest because they're at the work. They're going to get in an SUV and book it. Hotch, Jordan, Gina, and Rossi are going to go to the house because maybe he's going there. The dad is talking about how he can't move on. And like, I can't believe that like you couldn't move on. The wife is like, what are you talking about? For a second, I was like, is the daughter not dead? Like, was that fake? Because the wife is like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, I don't know why you're so upset right now. And I was like, quick pause. Did
what the fuck?
What? What the fuck? Yeah. And then, oh yeah, Reed is like, turn here, turn right here. And Derek does. And he's like, I'm going to need a little more notice than that, kid. And Reed is just like, sorry.
Get his ass.
Great. And the wife is like, I think you blame me. Like, I know that you blame me. And the wife's like, blame you for what? And I truly was like, the girl is not dead. Or something. Like, I was like, something else is up. No, he was just having a delusion. Reed is very funny with how every time Derek, like, turns, Reed is like, eh. Which I enjoy. Norman rolls down his window, pulls out his gun. He's like shooting at the cop, and the family's like, what are you doing? And he's like, I tried to tell you, but you wouldn't listen. Derek is like, Reed, does he look like he's going home? And it's like, yeah, every time he circles, he's like getting closer and closer to his house. Which is interesting, right? Because he like left his house, and now he's like circling back toward his house. He doesn't know what he's doing.
He's in a bad way.
He's having a hard time. Gina Torres, Jordan, and Hotch get to the house. I wrote, I swear to God, Derek's driving up and down the same streets. And I know they said he was, like, circling, but I'm pretty sure they just filmed the same street over and over again. I kind of hoped we wouldn't notice, but I noticed.
But we did. Hey, Criminal Minds, we fucking noticed.
The husband's like, how could you move on? And the wife's like, I cry every day, yada, yada. So much tire squealing. Oh, Derek, like, spots the chase and, like, does this, like, crazy, like, we're circling, we're flying, we're doing all this stuff. Squeal, 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 blah, 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 blah. Great. Now they're chasing after the car. Ross, he's like ringing the doorbell at the house. He's knocking. Where are they? You know, whatever. But her car is here. Let's go around the back. And the husband is like, we're never going to be a family again in that house. And the wife is like, fine, it's your fault. You let her die. You had her and you let her die. The team goes back to the house, goes into the house. They see all the cars. Hotch walks up to a car and it's just like a 1987 Aston Martin. Blah, blah. It's James Bond's car from Goldfinger. But I was like, Hotch, you know, like you were like, here's the model, the year. Weeb.
Little fucking dweeb ass bitch.
Nerd ass bitch. Yeah. Back to the chase. Reed telling everybody. Oh, Reed gets the walkie-talkie and is like, we're on the chase, back up, let us take the lead. He's a deranged suspect. Okay.
Reed says a lot of words here, and the only word the cop says in response is, copy.
Reed is like, blah, 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 copy.
You couldn't have said that shorter, bud. You couldn't
this
have said...
This is the BAU, let us take the lead. Copy. Like,
exactly. Yeah.
No, we had to know he's deranged.
This is the behavioral analysis unit. We are on the scene. Let us take the scene. Let's take the lead. Is it deranged? Like, girl, shut the fuck up. Girl, if you don't use an acronym, bitch.
Bitch. Yeah. The team goes into the house. It smells awful. And I wrote, uh-oh, they're dead.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. They split up. And I was like, they don't have their guns out. And they're not being, like, clear. Because the guy's in the car. They know he's not home, right?
Yeah.
Hotch opens Brittany's room and immediately, like, full body winces. Uh-oh. Jordan opens Sasha's room, full body winces. Uh-oh. And then I wrote, then who's in the car? Nobody. He's driving, and, like, in the car, the wife, like, reaches over and jerks the wheel, and the whole car just flips, hits the cop car, like.
They do a big roll.
Yeah. If I knew I wouldn't get hurt, I would want to go somewhere remote and just see if any of this actually is, like, real.
God, you have no idea how much I want to just, like, fuck up a car sometimes. I shouldn't, because, like, That'd be bad, and I would get injured. But God, I want just once.
Just go fast and just yank the wheel and see if it actually flips you. That's all I want to know.
I will not be doing that experiment.
Me neither.
There is a Mythbusters episode about that for sure, right?
There might be. Let us know in the comments.
The comments that we historically have.
Let us know in the, I don't know, messages or something. Send a pigeon. Real. Okay, the car flips. It's a cop car. We go into the main bedroom at the house and we see bloody sheets. And it's like, oh, no. Norman, like, the car turned over. He's all bloody and his wife is, like, hanging down bloody, being like, this is your fault. Okay, the sound cuts out. Derek, like, gets out of his car and he's, like, shouting for everyone to lower their guns. But the sound is, like, it's silent and, like, slightly slow-mo. And I was like, again? We just had, like, silent slow-mo last episode.
So soon?
And then he's like, don't shoot, don't shoot. But then he puts his gun up.
So, like, yeah, I thought that was really fucking stupid.
Well, no, I think the thing is like, he knows he's not going to shoot Norman unless he absolutely has to. But he's, like, getting everybody else under control, being like, none of you shoot. I'm not going to shoot unless I have to, but I don't want anyone else. Whatever. And then Derek is all like, nobody's in that car. Your family's gone, Norman. Look inside. Look in the car. They were never there. It's over. I mean, it flashbacks to him dissociating. And it's that first night with the dressing gown. And he, like, goes in crying at Jenny's door. And then I wrote, I miss Jenny, Jiro. I'm crying at Jenny's door, too.
She's here this episode.
Not yet, though. If you didn't know, you wouldn't know. And I was sad. Let me be sad. Okay.
All right.
Your family's gone, Norman. He starts panicking. Derek handcuffs him and is like, we're going to get you some help. Jail help, I hope. Jordan comes out of the house, falls to her knees, and Rossi comes over and she's like, did I do this? Like, is this my fault? And Rossi's like, no, they were dead before we even got the case. And Jordan's like, I'm not sure I can do this. And Rossi says, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. And I think this moment kind of does two things. I think it kind of, like, it feels almost like a season one moment, but, like, in the same way in season one, Elle kept being like, how do we do this job? And Gideon was like, you suck it the fuck up. Like, you do this job and you fucking deal with it in silence. I think this is a really nice kind of, like, 180, where they're like, hey, if you can't do it, you can't do it. And that's fine. Like, it's okay. You know, and when Reed is like, I don't want to get jaded, Gideon's like, then don't get jaded. You know, and Jordan is like, I can't do this. Like, I thought I could, and it was fine when I was just flirting with Emily and, you know, answering phone calls. But, like, it's crazy to do this all the time. And I think the second thing this tells us is it says a lot about JJ.
Yeah.
You know, like, JJ's been doing this for so long, and she's had, you know, moments where she's like, it's hard when they look like me, or like, it's hard, you know, what if I don't pick the right person, you know. And she tells the story of, JJ tells the story to Emily of, like, one time we didn't take a case and her boyfriend, like, threw acid in her face. Like, JJ deals with that, but she's solid as a rock. Mm-hmm. Like, you're never worried she's gonna, like, quit. So I think it really says a lot about JJ that, like, you know, it does take a certain type of person to do this job, and it does take a certain kind of strength and compartmentalizing. Like, it's okay to be unfit for this job, but it's also really impressive to be fit for this job.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And even, you know, in Revelations, when JJ asks Emily, like, how do you handle all this? And Emily's like, oh, I compartmentalize, you know? Like, even then, when JJ is, you know, quote-unquote weak after she almost gotten eaten alive by dogs, you know, that's still, like, that would have broken a weaker person. And JJ, like, doesn't even, like flinch. Get off the case. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's, like, I just think it's really interesting. I think it really tells how, you know, strong JJ is. And can I have a moment to talk about the fandom really quick? I've seen some posts recently about Jordan that I assume are in response to me supporting Jordan so loudly. People just saying that, like, you know, JJ, you know, Jade is absolutely replaceable. Like, we see it when Jordan takes her job, and we see it when they, like, split her job between Penelope and Hotch later, and, like, clearly, like, she's very replaceable. That job isn't even necessary. But I would say that, like, seeing Jordan doesn't quit because JJ comes back. Like, her time doesn't run out. She has to leave for her own sanity. And the fact that JJ's job has to be split among several people later shows how much she is doing.
I was going to say, also, doesn't it not turn out that well at the beginning when they're splitting her job up? Like, well, they struggle with that.
They do struggle with it. They have to kind of figure out, like, who gets what part. Because Penelope tries to do her job, but Penelope, like, can't do the press conferences, and, like, it's a lot to deal with the families and, like, all that kind of stuff, you know? So they end up, like, spreading her job amongst the team, and then they end up taking up, you know, everyone does kind of press conferences, whoever fits the most. But I think JJ, like, is very singular in the way she can kind of handle all this negativity, not just seeing the crimes, but talking to these locals, talking to these families, making choices that could be right or wrong, you know. I think it says a lot about her that she's able to handle all of that and do all of this work and still be kind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's very impressive. This is minor spoiler, I guess, but JJ will eventually become a profiler. And I like it. It feels fine. I wish she had stayed administration and have gone on the path to be unit chief. But I really enjoy her as a liaison. I really like her as kind of like the normie of the group.
Yeah, I do like it as well.
Yeah. Anyway, I just wanted to say that person was very wrong. And I disagree. Great. Eisenhower quote. Then we get home. I liked this little moment. Emily's like, has anyone noticed how the trip home always seems to go so much faster? And Reed's like, oh, it's because the tailwinds are in our favor. And Emily's like, no, I meant because anyone want to get something to eat? She's like, I don't have the energy.
She's like, I don't even want to bother right now.
It reminds me of the time when they're like, you know, Penelope and Kevin sitting in a tree. And Reed's like, what's that song? And Emily's like, it's never mind. Like, she's like, I don't have the energy. But this moment made me laugh because I was like, she does this multiple times. Emily is not this like magnanimous, I'm going to teach Reed every social thing he's never heard. It's actually like, no. She's like, no, I can't do this. Is anyone want to get something to eat?
I want to get a burger. Real.
Burger. Okay, there's a blonde in the briefing room. Reed calls it the BAU room. Hey, there's someone in the BAU room.
What is this room actually called?
Sorry, the what?
We've gone from, like, the round table room to the briefing room to the BAU room?
Sorry, nobody else is allowed? No one else is allowed to use this room?
Nobody else has a key to that room. And keep that shit locked up.
Okay, it's JJ. Emily? Okay.
It's JJ, she's back for a second.
Emily sees JJ, her mouth falls open. She's literally like, oh, JJ! Girlfriends.
Okay. They're so
in love. And then Emily comes over and is like, that's your child. Like, that's your baby. Like, she's like, that's a baby.
No shit, Sherlock. Thanks for that one. Like,
everyone's so excited. And then Hotch is like, I thought I gave you strict orders to keep this place out of your head for a while. But we learned that Penelope texted JJ and was like, hey, they're on their way back. You want to, like, come by? And JJ was like, yeah, sure. So Penelope comes in. She's like, my bad. Just like a bottle. And JJ's holding the baby, Henry. And is like, I just realized that after all we do and see in this room, I never smile. I just wanted one good memory to hold on to. And then it cuts to Emily looking devastated at this comment. Emily is like, JJ was sad. I didn't know she was sad. The baby's gonna be good. So then Derek is just like, excuse me, so sorry, everybody move, can I hold the baby? And they hand the baby over, and Emily's like, hold the head, you have to watch out, be careful, oh, be so careful, oh, be careful with JJ's baby, Derek. And it's so cute. And Derek is like bouncing Henry and is like, he's smiling at me. And Penelope and Emily go, gas.
Real.
Yeah. JJ goes over to Hotch, and this made me laugh out loud. JJ looks at Hotch and goes, "You're smiling." And Hotch goes, "Gas." I had never caught that before. And he like says the same thing they did about the baby. He's like, "It's gas."
They're no, truly comedy geniuses, I think.
Actually, Hotch is so funny. And then Hotch is like, "We miss you." And JJ's all like blushing and like, "Oh, thanks." Aww.
Can I say, I love Please. That Derek is the first one to try and hold that baby. That man made to hold the baby. Truly made to.
He should be a dad so fast.
This man, born to be a DILF. Truly born to be a DILF.
Born a DILF. Born a DILF.
This is such a cute moment, though. I love little, like, little family moment at the end here. I love it. I think it's so cute.
I realized that we didn't rate this beforehand.
We did not.
That's okay.
What are you rating it now?
I, like, don't know. Maybe, like, a 6?
I was also thinking, like, 6-ish.
Like, it's not special, but it's also not, like, bad.
It's not bad. It's not good. It's an interesting little time capsule.
Yeah. It's got enough, like, small moments. And obviously, JJ's back. For me to give it on the positive, you know, give it a 6.
JJ's appearance brings it up from a 5 to a 6 for me.
Absolutely. There's also, like, there's enough, like, little commentary. Or, like, there's enough there for us to talk about, you know. But we've both agreed that, like, being able to talk about it for a long time doesn't make an episode good.
Yeah. Real.
Yeah. So I give it a 6.
6 is fair. I think that's also where I'm going to give it. They did say the name of the episode within the episode, obviously, a bunch of fucking times. And this one was not God or the devil. It was just some guy. Unless you consider the devil to be patriarchy, which I would. But I also don't think that would count for the...
The devil is a cishet white man.
Literally. Next time. Wait, sorry. Before I do next time, you can find us anywhere you get your podcasts. We would appreciate it if you leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or rate us highly on Spotify. You can find us anywhere you get your socials. Wheels Up Pod on Twitter and Tumblr, mostly. And that's it. Next week, we are watching Season 4, Episode 12, Soulmates, which I'm calling it now, is going to be an episode that you and I will talk about for a very long time. Because there's a lot of, like, it very heavily, I think, references an episode that I really liked in Season 3.
What episode?
This Soulmates feels very much like a reference and like a play off of Third Life, and I really liked Third Life. So... You'll see once we actually go to watch the episode. But that is next time. Until then, James, do you have an ending quote for me, bestie?
I do. As Emily Prentice says, you have no idea how many middle-aged white men have someone think they're a serial killer.
And she's so right.